Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And before we start our conversation today, we're going to spend a bit of time just flagging up that what we're going to be talking about today is the painful topic of baby loss and miscarriage. We want to stay right at the top. That might not be suitable for everyone to listen to, particularly for those for whom it might have affected you or those you love personally. So if that's you, please feel free to skip this episode and we'll see you next week. But also we want to say that we're very aware that this is a conversation between two men about an issue which, you know, primarily but not exclusively does affect women. And so we want to say that we're aware of that, and we spent a lot of time thinking and reading stories from women and others. On top of that, miscarriage and baby loss, while primarily something experienced by women, is not solely experienced by women. And actually, every pregnancy inevitably begins with a man and a woman together. Every child has a father. And so men are involved, like whether they like it or not. There's often, you know, men are involved trying to support their partners who have gone through baby loss and miscarriage. But also, as we'll discuss later on, themselves often very directly affected by the tragedy. And I think we both feel quite strongly, don't we, that actually this is not an issue which should be kind of hived off as a quote unquote women's issue. But because it affects everyone, men and women alike, it should be discussed across the kind of social space and not kind of relegated to as a secondary concern only for women to think about.
Absolutely. So, I mean, as a paediatrician who cared a lot for many dying babies, the issue about stillbirth, neonatal death is something that's been very close to me professionally. But it is interesting how this, what's actually triggered us to take this, to do this podcast is the fact that it just last week, it was Baby Loss Awareness Week, which is an annual event organized by a coalition of organizations who are involved, particularly SANDS, which is the Stillbirth and Neonatal Death Society. And they try to raise the profile of miscarriage and stillbirth and raise awareness of it. And, you know, this is something that I think is a really important topic. I mean, I think they haven't done incredibly well in getting much traction in the public arena. I don't know. Were you aware of this before we started talking about it?
Unfortunately not. No, I'm afraid to say. I mean, I've come across some of the charities involved before. You kind of sometimes hear about them and their fundraising efforts. But no, I'm afraid to say Baby Loss Awareness Week totally passed me by. And I suspect probably quite a lot of other people, unfortunately, because I think it's a really creditable effort to say, actually, you know, this is an issue which has been in the shadows of our society for a long time, and it's long past time that we brought it out into the light, as it were.
Yes. So I think one way in, which is just to see, read some of the stories on the Baby Loss Awareness Week. We'll put in a link in the show notes, and we recommend that you go and visit the website and just read some of the stories there, which are quite moving and striking.
Yeah, that's right. We wanted to share a handful of those just to kind of set the tone. The one that jumped out at me when I was reading some of these stories was from a woman, a mother called Elsie, and she is 18, and she experienced two miscarriages, a baby called Lyra, who died at 11 weeks, and another son called Lionel, who died at 4 weeks. And she was just 16 years old at the time. And she wrote this: "The staff at the hospital were really lovely at the early pregnancy unit. The midwife, when I found out that I lost, she was even crying. But I found that there's no support after you leave hospital. I tried lots of different places and people. Some were helpful and some were not. A lot of places don't feel right for me because everyone was a lot older than me, so I didn't relate it with their lives. People always blame it on me due to my age, but it's not my fault, and I know that. People just care about my age and not my grief. People say, at least you were young, or at least you will live better. Having a miscarriage and a chemical pregnancy is really difficult, especially at my age, because no one understands or can relate. A lot of people were like, you've got the future, it doesn't matter. It can feel like sometimes with older people, they're like, oh my God, we're here for you, but that support isn't there for a young person. I'm fed up with at least this, at least that. No mum ever deserves that. Every mama deserves to have their grief accepted. Their babies don't deserve to be forgotten about. Their babies are valid. They existed. They are real and they happened. They existed if only for a minute or an hour or a week or a month or even half a year. Those babies lived, and that deserves to be known."
It's a very passionate and moving cry, isn't it? And it's striking that, you know, these are very early miscarriages, and yet for this lady, Elsie, these are two babies, they've got names, and she wants for society to recognise that these babies existed and were significant.
Yeah, and that there's something, there's almost a kind of re-traumatisation, you know, you have the initial shock and grief of the miscarriage, but then when that's not acknowledged in the way that you believe it should be, when that's dismissed, you know, people say, well, you're young, you'll get pregnant again, it actually, in some sense, she appears to be saying, is a kind of a second grief, a re-traumatization, which is a really important, I think, for those of us, you know, talking to people who've experienced miscarriage, to remember.
That's right. I mean, there's another story on the Baby Loss Awareness Week website, Jo's story. And she says, between 2010 to 2018, I lost 15 babies. We worked with fantastic medical professionals over the years, but no one could ever find out why we were losing each pregnancy. It was the not knowing that was one of the most difficult aspects of the losses. I went into every pregnancy with crippling anxiety that things would go wrong. Each pregnancy, I set little milestones to try and focus on the immediate and not fixate on how unlikely it was that I would make it to full term. Reading stories from other people who are going through similar losses helped me to feel a little less alone, which is why I want to share my story. Eventually, we now have two beautiful rainbow babies and will feel eternally grateful, but the grief and heartbreak of those 15 losses have fundamentally changed me forever."
Hmm. I mean, I don't know how it feels to you, but I'm kind of almost in awe of people like Jo who can, you know, go through 15 miscarriages before they manage to successfully kind of carry a child to term, and the kind of determination and perseverance and the drive to keep on living with that grief and that suffering is, yeah, it's absolutely astonishing, remarkable to me.
And I am aware that, you know, not all these stories end happily, and there are many examples, mm-hmm. tragically, of couples who desperately want to have a child, have a recurrent series of miscarriages, and in the end feel that they're never going to be parents. And I think that this is something we really need to be sensitive about, those of us who are parents and have young babies, you know. And I think it's a continuing problem in the church, isn't it? That often local churches are very child-centered. There's a lot of celebration about babies and families, and we just tend to forget the people sitting there who have had this continual story of miscarriage and of what they see as losing babies.
Yeah, and we mentioned this, didn't we, in previous podcasts around infertility and reproductive treatment, that for whatever reason, the evangelical church has kind of gone down a bit of a cul-de-sac in kind of idolizing the kind of nuclear family and the kind of squeaky clean mum, dad, 2.2 children, Labrador, and semi-detached home, and that's painful enough for someone, for a couple perhaps who have been trying to conceive for years without success, but even more kind of hard to sit in the pews as someone who might have had a series of miscarriages, to spend so much time in an institution that is so geared around, as you say, the kind of happy bouncing babies on their mother's knees.
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things is to take a kind of biographical, historical view of miscarriage, because of course this reality has been around since the dawn of time. Statistics actually are very hard to come by, and it's very difficult to get very reliable statistics, but a reasonably reputable statistic is that 1 in 5 of pregnancies will end in a miscarriage, and 1 in 6 of people who know they are pregnant. So this is common, and yet until now, until very recently, it was largely suppressed, wasn't it, and just put aside as something that was intensely private and not to be discussed.
Yeah, definitely. You definitely got the sense, kind of growing up, at least I did in the 90s and the noughties, that you were aware that this was a thing that sometimes happened, but you only really came across it very removed. You know, I never had people tell me, you know, oh, my mum and dad had a miscarriage, or even I had a miscarriage. I'm talking to some older generations. It was seen as, you know, well, that's not real bereavement. That's not real grief. It's upsetting, sure, but, you know, you'll get over it and get pregnant next time and life kind of moves on. And it wasn't really, it felt like the language around it didn't really acknowledge or recognize what impact it might have been having on these mothers.
Yeah, so I think there was both a great deal of insensitivity, including, I think, especially from male medical professionals, or medical professionals in general, I think, both male and female, probably didn't have the kind of understanding of the emotional significance which we now have. But I think also it was just regarded as intensely private. I mean, my parents, we have four children. They had four children. I was one of four. There was a big gap between number three and number four. And it was only when I was, you know, probably in my late teens that I worked out, or from hints they dropped, that my mother had had a miscarriage after the third pregnancy, between the third and the fourth child, and that this had been a very painful and difficult experience, but it was entirely hushed up and not talked about. And I think they would have felt it was entirely inappropriate to talk about it in public.
Yeah. And on one level, I think it's important to recognise that's an understandable response. And maybe for a lot of women, the sense of privacy wasn't because, you know, society was stigmatising and silencing them, but actually because they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't find it helpful to bring in the wider networks of friends and families. You know, what could be done ultimately? It was an irreversible, unpredictable tragedy. And so maybe, you know, a lot of people felt, actually, this is not something I want to kind of expose my vulnerabilities to the world.
So, you know, fast forward two generations, what's your, you know, amongst young marrieds, people trying to have babies and so on, what's your perception now in your generation?
Yeah, I think it's remarkably different. I mean, I acknowledge that my kind of circle of friends and family at similar age are not in any way representative of the whole generation. And particularly, you know, the vast majority of them would be kind of practicing Christians, and potentially that shapes how people respond to miscarriage. But certainly there's much greater openness. You know, off the top of my head, I could think of 5, 6, 7 couples I know of who have experienced miscarriage, who have either kind of just outright told us, sometimes during the time, because they were looking for kind of pastoral support, for care, and more often maybe a little after the time is passed, and it kind of is just mentioned as one of those things, you know, last year was tough for us because, you know, on this point, you know, we suffered a miscarriage. So there's certainly much, much less of a sense that this is by default a thing that it is inappropriate to talk about with other people, or a thing that is so private that it should not be shared. I'm sure there are even more people who have had miscarriages who haven't told me about it. So I'm sure the numbers are even higher, but there's certainly quite a striking change in tone, I think, in that there is a sense in which both that this is not a private grief, but something that can be shared, but also actually that this is a real grief. You know, this is not just an unfortunate medical accident, but that, you know, these people are real parents of a real baby. And particularly for those of us who are Christians, you know, that child probably, you know, is with God in some sense. And, you know, maybe there are different views about this, but, you know, I think a lot of people talk about the fact that, you know, I'm not a father of two. I'm actually a father of three. You know, there's two right on earth with me, but I know there's a third son or daughter who I'll meet one day in the new creation. So that's quite a striking sense that actually this is a real valid experience of bereavement. You know, maybe not the same as losing a child who had actually been born, but certainly not something that should just be kind of swept under the rug as one of those things.
Yeah, and the statistics on mental health are really very striking. The government commissioned an independent pregnancy loss review, and a report came out in July 2023. And again, we'll link to that in the notes, but it's a very detailed review, and one of the things it discusses is the evidence of the impact of pregnancy loss on mental health. And for instance, a large recent study, 2019, 29% of women met the criteria for PTSD 1 month after early pregnancy loss. This decreased to 18% 9 months after the loss. Other statistics, 41% of women reported they suffered PTSD for a time following baby loss. 36% of women reported they still were suffering with PTSD. And 50% of women reported they suffered clinical depression following baby loss.
Yeah, really, really stark figures there, aren't they, about just how incredibly significant the impact. And this is kind of tells the lie to the kind of the old way of dealing with miscarriage, because, you know, even putting aside the broader changes in society around, you know, like emotional openness and things like that, any medical event which was causing, you know, these kind of mental health impacts should have been of greater concern to the medical professionals than it was. You know, if something else was happening to women and causing 50% or whatever it was to experience PTSD, like, it would have been taken much more seriously. So I think there was a bit of a dereliction of duty there.
Yeah, and one of the interesting questions is, what's the impact on men? What's the impact on partners? And that seems to have been much less studied. But certainly there's anecdotal evidence that some men find it desperately painful and difficult to come to terms with the miscarriage. So it simply isn't true that this is something that just affects women.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, what else did you make of the pregnancy loss review? There were some interesting recommendations, wasn't there, about recognizing and acknowledging a baby loss, particularly around this idea of creating a kind of official certificate.
Yeah, so there's a very strong drive amongst many, many parents who've lost a baby early on in pregnancy to have an official recognition of the child's existence. They find it extremely painful, understandably, that it's like the world just moves on and says, yeah, well, okay, that's your private loss, but really, you know, there's no official recognition that this life ever existed. So historically, you could only get a death certificate if the child had actually shown signs of life after birth. And then there was a stillbirth certificate, which was if the child was born after 24 weeks gestation but born dead. And it's only more recently that the the certification criteria have been loosened and made more applicable to early miscarriage. But the proposal, interestingly, from the Pregnancy Loss Review was that it ought to be possible for you to have a formal official government certificate for a miscarriage at any gestational age, including the possibility of naming the baby. But also the same should apply to historic cases, so that you ought to be able to say, you know, I had a miscarriage some years ago. This has never been recognised. I would like the government to issue a formal certificate. So it's quite a radical proposal, really. But I can see what's driving it, this need to have a public recognition that there was a baby there. There was someone there.
Yeah. And there was an interesting line I was just reading from the foreword by one of the review's authors, a woman called Zoe Clark Coates, who helps run Saying Goodbye, which is one of the biggest kind of charities supporting people who've gone through baby loss. And she talks about her own experience about how her and her husband lost five children, and how the kind of injustice she feels that they don't appear on the kind of family tree, you know, that they're kind of a silence, when from her perspective, these are just as much her children as all of her other children who actually, you know, are alive today. So I can certainly understand the kind of the injustice that is felt when it's kind of they exist only in your memories. You know, maybe they don't have a grave or a site that you can visit, that, you know, there's no recognition of the significance of that life, even if it was short.
Yeah. And I think there's still a great deal of work to do. The review, a lot of the review is making recommendations for professionals. And there are repeated complaints that professionals are insensitive, that hospitals don't recognise the significance of, for instance, if a woman comes because of vaginal, you know, a pregnant woman comes to vaginal bleeding, comes to an A&E department, and an ultrasound scan is done and it shows that in fact the baby has died, then how is the woman treated in the A&E department? And I mean, you can see the challenge, can't you? You know, it's a busy, maybe it's the middle of the night, there are all kinds of things going on. The Pregnancy Loss Review is arguing that hospitals should have special procedures for this eventuality. They should have separate rooms, you know, that the woman should be treated with sensitivity and offered support and emotional care and so on. I think there's a lot to do in terms of raising the awareness just amongst health professionals, let alone amongst the general public.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Definitely. I mean, what kind of training did you have as a doctor on how to handle miscarriage or pregnancy loss? Admittedly, some time ago now, but...
Yes, indeed. Well, the short answer was none at all, I think. I mean, you know, it was known as a phenomenon, but from a medical point of view, all you're worried about is the complications. So, you know, you're worried about, yes, infection, hemorrhage, you know, what was called retained products of conception, where you would then need to have a surgical procedure. But, you know, it's a typical medical approach. You know, all you're thinking about is what could go wrong medically and how to fix it. You're not really thinking about, you know, how is this person responding emotionally to this loss. And it's one of the problems in medicine is it inevitably, because you would see this in a very, you know, particularly if you were working in gynecology, this is completely routine. You would be seeing this very, very commonly. Inevitably, a kind of callousness, a kind of hard, hardness, it can easily happen. And particularly, I think male doctors can be incredibly insensitive.
I mean, this probably is an issue in a lot of medicine, but, you know, I'd even recognise it in some aspects of my work as a journalist, is that sometimes the person I'm speaking to, or what I'm the event I'm asking questions about, is the worst thing that's ever happened to them. Whereas for me, this might be the 10th or the 30th or the 100th time I've covered such a story. And so you inevitably become desensitised to it. And I guess there's a challenge for every doctor, but particularly for those working in this field, to say, you know, miscarriage is not new or surprising to you, but it's probably the most upsetting thing that might have ever happened to this young woman in her late 20s or early 30s.
That's right. Interestingly, and I was quite struck by, there's a bit in the review where it talks about, actually, there are lots of health professionals themselves who've had miscarriages, you know, lots of midwives, lots of nurses, lots of women, and then saying, well, then how are they coping with this, you know, and how are they responding? And I think, again, there's a kind of psychological mechanism which health professionals do, which is a kind of compartmentalization. You know, you put your own personal feelings, reactions, emotions onto one side. You say, this is a clinical problem, how can I respond to this patient? And sometimes that's not always healthy. Sometimes recognizing and being honest about, this is something that impacts me too, and I understand what it's like, you know, is helpful.
And how do you feel kind of confident that NHS kind of gynecology services are moving in the right direction, from the kind of trajectory of the 1970s when you were training through to the present day? Does it feel like, you know, if a woman who experiences a miscarriage today in 2023 is going to have a significantly better experience than they might have done 20 or 30 years earlier?
I think yes, in theory. So I think, for instance, medical students these days get a lot of input and training on sensitive communication, and including using actors, male and female, as surrogate patients. And my experience of using actors for communication training is they're remarkably, you know, professional actors are remarkably good at taking on these roles, and it's a very good way of training students and junior doctors. So I think I've no doubt that the training is already there, and that following this kind of baby loss, pregnancy loss review, it will become even more, there'll be even more training. Interestingly, one of the health professionals which have been recognised as very important are the ultrasonographers who do the antenatal scan, because it's often the ultrasonographer who's the first person. And they may not be a doctor, they usually aren't. They're usually, it's a separate profession, but they suddenly find themselves pitchforked into, you know, I've just done the scan, there isn't a heartbeat, what do I do now? So they are being, you know, there's a big move to make sure better training, better awareness, and all the rest. So I think it is true that there's a much greater awareness now of the importance of training. You've got to set that against the realities of what the NHS is currently struggling with, which is, you know, it's hard enough keeping people alive and making sure they get essential life-saving treatment, let alone providing, you know, really sensitive, thoughtful, compassionate care for someone who, from a clinical, medical point of view, this is not a life-threatening emergency.
And how do you think we should feel as believers, as Christians, about this kind of cultural shift that we've been sketching out, about the radical change in the way that we think about baby loss and miscarriage? Is this like an unmitigated good thing from our perspective?
Well, I think I would want to argue it is. Is it unmitigated? Well, you know, you can see how it raises all kinds of other questions and challenges. One of the interesting questions I'd like to ask is, to what extent are church leaders, pastors, people training to be vicars and so on, to what extent are they aware of all this? because you could certainly imagine that sitting in the congregation will be a significant number of people who've had miscarriage. I mean, have you ever heard a sermon about this? Would it be helpful for to discuss this and name it? And similar to infertility, I mean, these are very important issues for very many people.
And I think it's also important to think about how do we preach about the many Bible passages that tackle subjects around, you know, pregnancy, childbirth, stillbirth, child loss, and even, you know, mothers dying, you know, when these, let alone kind of standalone sermons, but these passages, when they come up in our preaching and our sermon series, are preachers and church leaders giving kind of serious thought to how they will be heard by women in their congregation who might have experienced baby loss. You know, because me as a man, I'm going to hear that story about, I don't know, Rachel and Leah or something like that very differently to someone sitting next to me in the pew who's actually had real first-hand experience of baby loss.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I think there is a danger that often when people preach, particularly from the Old Testament stories, that these stories are treated almost like just parables that we can make a spiritual point about, and we sort of glide over almost the fact that these are real people with real agonies, and that there are huge pastoral implications here. Both that it would be incredibly pastorally insensitive not to recognize that, you know, that there are people here who may have been personally affected by these issues, but also plus it would be, there are opportunities for Christians really engaging with heartfelt concerns for many people.
Absolutely. You know, the example that comes to my mind is hearing preaching about the Christmas story, which you kind of become very familiar with. But I remember being in my kind of early teens when I first had a preacher kind of really dwell on the fact that for Mary to become pregnant as an unmarried person, when she said yes to God, that was, the social consequences of that were devastating for her, and that she was opening herself up to the possibility of even kind of an honor style killing, you know, by Joseph or his family, and at best kind of social stigma and disgrace. And so it wasn't just like, oh my gosh, you know, there's a big spiritual story here about the incarnation and God, you know, coming to earth as a human being. But there's also, you have to understand the great sacrifice and cost of the people involved, and think about, you know, it's hard enough in our time for kind of single, unmarried teenage women to become pregnant and carry those children through to term. How much harder must it have been 2000 years ago in the kind of deeply patriarchal society of first century Judea? And it's actually, as you say, it's really important for us to get a holistic view of particularly the Old Testament, which feels so distant, and see these as real living, breathing human beings who would have experienced the same kind of emotions that we would have experienced and put in the same situation. I think the other thing to say, you know, whether we were talking about whether we would kind of welcome this cultural shift as believers, is for me, yes, absolutely, in the sense that it is much more sensitive to the needs of mothers and fathers, as we mentioned, experiencing baby loss, and that it recognizes their own kind of dignity and humanity that's been, you know, marred by their grief and by their bereavement. But secondarily, I think it's welcome because it seems to me to be a more authentically Christian approach to the status of the unborn child, rather than saying this is just a kind of mass growing in the woman's womb, and if it disappears, well, you know, that's unfortunate. Try again next time, which is the kind of implicit theology, as you were, of how it used to be handled. I feel like unintentionally, perhaps because it's mostly been driven by secular groups, but today's kind of much more empathic and compassionate response to miscarriage actually feels like a more authentically Christian and truthful language and vocabulary to adopt around babies, which is that they are valued and precious, and they do carry a common humanity with us, and that they're not kind of accidental and random and can be discarded without a thought, but they leave behind, you know, lifelong ripples and consequences, even if they never actually manage to live beyond 12 or 18 or 24 weeks.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's interesting, you know, in the scriptures, there are many examples, well, a number of examples where an unborn child is part of the actor in the narrative, is part of the part of the drama. But of course, up until the last few decades, it was impossible to know anything about the baby in the womb. It was a kind of just utterly mysterious phenomenon. Whereas ultrasound has now completely changed the experience of pregnancy. And this ability to have really high resolution images going all the way down to a few weeks gestation. I've got an ultrasound scan I found on the internet, which shows it's a very, very early ultrasound. And there's this tiny little piece of tissue in the middle, but the parents have taken this ultrasound scan and put a great big heart around it. And it says, "We're having a baby." And it's the way that ultrasound actually allows you to see the very early pregnancy is a remarkable phenomenon. And it's just interesting how technology then changes the psychology. Mm-hmm. At least it influences the psychology.
And, you know, maybe we'd go as far to say ultrasound gives us a fraction of an insight into that unborn child that God has. You know, God is not unable to discern the depths of the womb like we are, but God has always seen and known these children. And now in a sliver of the way that God sees a child, we as parents, as societies, can see and recognize these children a little bit more for who they are. And I think that can probably only be a really positive thing.
Have you ever wondered if angel stories are real or just religious folklore? This month, Premier Insight is offering a fascinating ebook called The Case for Angels: Evidence, Encounters, and Scripture. It examines real-life testimonies, biblical insight, and reasoned arguments for the reality of angels today. If you're curious about the supernatural or how to talk about it with skeptics, this resource is for you. It's yours today as a thank you for your gift to Premier Insight. Get your copy now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your ebook today. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Bird, co-host of the Ask NT Write Anything podcast, and I want to ask you, what exactly is the gospel? You'd think Christians would generally agree on this, but actually, there are some rich and important differences in how the gospel can be understood. That's why I edited with Jason Mastin a new book called 5 Views on the Gospel, part of the Counterpoint series from Zondervan Academic. We've gathered together 5 absolutely brilliant scholars: Michael Horton, Scott McKnight, David DeSilva, Julie Marr, and Shively Smith, each offering a different take on what the gospel really is. Justification by faith, declaring Jesus is king, spiritual transformation, liberation from oppression. I mean, each view is, in a sense, rooted in scripture and history and contemporary mission, but they don't always agree. This book explores, what are we saved from? What are we saved for? And what does it mean to live a life worthy of the gospel? Whether you're a preacher, a student, or just curious, 5 Views on the Gospel will challenge and deepen your understanding of the good news of Jesus Christ. Available now wherever good theology books are sold.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
But we wanted to really kind of draw out that final point from the conversation on miscarriage and about the really healthy and helpful change in language and approach, the much more compassionate and kind of emotionally sensitive approach that recognizes children who die before they're born are still children, are still babies. And talk about what that means or how that affects the conversation we also have in society around abortion.
Yeah, it is an extraordinary phenomenon that miscarriage and abortion are both extremely common. And yet the narratives that surround them are very different. And so if we just review what's been happening with abortion in the UK, and I think perhaps the first thing just to say, I know we have many listeners around the world, including in the US, where the whole context in which abortion occurs is very, very different. And so it might be worth just very briefly recapping how abortion developed in the UK. I think the important point is that, first of all, we had one of the very first abortion laws in the world, and it was framed, a legal abortion was framed entirely in terms of medical risk. It's interesting that in the law it really says nothing about a mother's choice. It's entirely framed in terms of the risk to the mother's health and life, or the health and welfare of existing children. And it's two doctors who have to determine whether the risks of continuing the pregnancy are greater than having an abortion. And but also importantly, once that act came in 1967, the NHS rapidly regarded providing legal abortions according to the Abortion Act was an NHS responsibility. And it became part of universal healthcare. And so every NHS region, every district, every hospital had to ensure that it was providing an abortion service under the terms of the Act. And of course, this is very different from what happened in the US, where the majority of mainstream health providers and hospitals decided that they didn't want to be involved in abortion, and therefore it was something almost entirely carried out by charities such as Planned Parenthood. So ever since then, we have had freely available abortion under the NHS, provided it met the criteria of the Act. And over the years, there's been a sort of progressive increase in numbers, steadily increasing overall year by year. And that increase has remained a huge matter of concern, not just for those who are really concerned about the morality of abortion, but also just from a public health point of view. Because it was always said, once you make universal sex education and free contraception available, it was always predicted that the need for abortion will wither away. Why on earth would you need that? If everybody understood, had proper sex education and access to free contraception, unplanned pregnancy will become increasingly rare. And yet, we seem to be seeing exactly the reverse, that rates continue to rise.
And that's the case even though, encouragingly, the UK has seen a lot of progress in reducing the incidence of teenage pregnancy and things like that, which was a huge kind of cause for concern in the kind of 80s and 90s. And actually, numbers have been steadily dropping since then. And so I suppose a lot of the people who are having abortions are not going to be your kind of stereotypical 17-year-old girl who accidentally fell pregnant with her boyfriend and is, you know, too young or terrified about the prospect of becoming a mother. You know, a lot of people having abortions are going to be women in their 20s and 30s who are in stable long-term relationships, but for various reasons decide, I do not want to see this pregnancy through.
That's absolutely right. And there has been a dramatic fall in teenage pregnancies, and probably a major factor has been the use of long-term implantable contraception, which means that a person doesn't have to remember to take a contraceptive pill or use a condom or something like that. But the peak age group for abortions is in the early to mid-20s. But as you say, many of the people who are having abortions are in stable relationships, by no means not all. And one way of looking at this is that the mean age of onset of regular intercourse is about 16 in our country at the moment. The mean age at which women want to have their first baby is around 30. And so if you just put it like that, what it says is that many people in our society want to have regular intercourse, but they don't want to have a baby for whatever reason. And that means it's almost inevitable there are going to be unplanned pregnancies, there are going to be contraceptive failures, there are going to be, you know, social events and coerced unplanned sex and all the rest. So, but nonetheless, the continuing rise in abortion rates are a matter of concern. And what the evidence is now coming out that here in the UK, we've seen quite a significant rise just in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yes. And is that being driven by something to do with the pandemic? Do we understand what is behind that?
I don't think we do. And actually, there's a bit of a problem because we don't have the latest figures. The latest figures we have in the UK were the first 6 months of 2022. But this showed a 17% increase on 2021, which is itself quite striking. And there is anecdotal evidence that in 2023, one of the major abortion providers reported an increase of about 30% on year on year in the number of abortions they were providing. So there certainly seems to be a very significant increase. Now, and what the reasons are, I think, is still largely a matter of speculation.
Okay, so we've got increasing numbers of abortion, and despite a quite medicalized framework passed in the original 1967 Act, in reality, it has been interpreted or used by the NHS to effectively offer abortion on demand. You do have to give a formal reason, but one of the reasons is, you know, I'm paraphrasing, it would cause, you know, harm to the mother's mental health. And so women overwhelmingly select that option as their kind of justification for why they would like an abortion. And on the whole, that's not questioned or probed. That's just accepted as a matter of fact.
Well, just to correct you, the women don't select the option. It's the doctor who is responsible to decide under which ground the abortion. So it's the doctor who says this abortion would be appropriate under, and it's a particular ground which says continuing the pregnancy has a greater risk to the mental health or physical health of the mother than performing abortion. And the statistics show that an early abortion performed under good medical conditions has a lower risk to the mother compared with a pregnancy continuing to term and delivering a baby at term. And therefore, effectively, a doctor could argue that in any case, virtually any case, the risks of doing an abortion are less than the risks of continuing the pregnancy.
And in reality, it's unheard of for women who wish to have an abortion to be refused, whatever their circumstances, as long as they meet the legal criteria in terms of gestation of the child, they are granted the right to an abortion.
Yes, the other criteria that the doctor has to, or whoever is assessing the person, is to assess that they are making a genuinely free choice. And that means that they, counsellors who are assessing women, are told that they must check, quotes, that the woman is not being coerced by anybody to have an abortion. And so, for instance, if she's seen at an abortion clinic, it is offered to her, if she comes with a partner, and if the counsellor suspects there is some coercion going on, the counsellor can ensure that the woman is seen in private alone, and that is offered, you know, can express whether or not she genuinely wants to go ahead with the abortion. So another important development in the narrative about abortion was the development of pills by post. It has been true that for many years, abortion activists have wanted to demedicalize the whole process of the abortion. They wanted to take it away from a medical control and make it something that could happen in a patient's home without direct medical involvement. And so this was always resisted by governments and by many doctors, and that was why the Abortion Act said that abortion could only take place in a licensed premises, and that was either an NHS hospital or a properly licensed abortion clinic. But what happened in the pandemic is that emergency regulations were brought in because of the risk of cross-infection, and it was agreed by Parliament that the requirement for a woman to attend an abortion clinic to receive the pills and be assessed would be taken away. And so we moved to what was called pills by post. And so the current situation, because it is now continuing in the same vein, the current situation is that a woman merely has to ring a number and say that she is pregnant and would like to have an abortion. She has a telephone consultation, and provided that she says that she's less than 10 weeks gestation, and the person on the end of the phone, who's the counsellor or midwife, is convinced that this is that she's acting genuinely and is not coerced, she will be sent a pack, including the abortion medication and also a pregnancy test to check after several weeks to see that the abortion has been successful. And so this is currently going on. And one of the, I think, interesting and disturbing factors is that it's not even necessary for the person's own general practitioner to be informed. This can be kept entirely confidential within the abortion clinic or wherever it's being managed. And apart from keeping statistics, nobody else need know.
Hmm. And has there been a general shift before this away from kind of surgical abortions towards medical abortions anyway? And this has kind of accelerated that, because previously you'd have to come to a clinic and take a pill. But already, am I right in thinking the majority of abortions were medical, you know, as a result of taking medication rather than having a surgical operation?
That's right. And so that this has been a big shift taking place over many years. Previously, it was the majority of abortions were actually performed as surgical procedures under a general anaesthetic in a hospital or an abortion clinic. But there's been a steady increase in the numbers of medical abortions using pills. And currently, I think the statistics are about 85% of all abortions in the UK are now medical. And the recent statistics suggest that about 50% of those are happening at home, without any involvement in a clinic. And
which is remarkable, given that until 2020, such a thing was literally impossible. And now almost half of all abortions now take place completely at home, outside of a medical setting, with, as you have expressed, very limited regulation or oversight or safeguards.
It is remarkable. And already we're starting to see those people who work in the area reporting, starting to see, you know, unanticipated consequences of all this. And if you think about it, you know, you imagine here is a woman, she may be married, or maybe in a stable relationship, she may be not in a stable relationship. She discovers she's pregnant, she agonizes about what to do, she phones the number, she gets the pills. Some counsellors have said that women have described, you know, I've got the pills, they're sitting on my kitchen table. I'm not sure whether I should take them or not. I keep staring at them. So you know, am I going to take them or not? And then if I do take them, I can have really quite unpleasant symptoms, cramping, pain, nausea, and then bleeding. And all this is going to take place in my bathroom. Hmm. Nobody need know what's going on. There might be other children in the flat. There might be other people there. Do they know what's going on? Are they aware of this, you know, this painful reality that's going on? And then we're having people saying, you know, it was a terrible thing that happened, and it all happened in my bathroom. And now every time I go to have a shower, I have flashbacks. And we've heard of people who said, I have to move from my flat. I cannot stay in that place. This is just too painful. So this kind of, it's just a very strange kind of shift in people's experience. And yet the statistics suggest, you know, that over 100,000 abortions will have taken place at home in the last year. And anecdotally, the numbers are increasing.
And it's striking to me as well that, you know, this was first introduced as a kind of temporary COVID measure when we were all locked down at homes. And it, you know, you can understand the rationale behind the argument that says, you know, previously women had to physically come into a clinic to get these pills, but they easily fit into an envelope. Why don't we temporarily make it a provision? But it is striking to me at how little debate there was about that at first. And then 2 years later, when the lockdown was long over, there was no pandemic justification for it, the government decided to extend this permanently and make it permanently available, again, with almost no, as far as I can recall, kind of public debate or conversation around it. As you're saying, quite a major reform to how abortion works in this country.
Yes, and that word reform is very loaded, isn't it? Because part of me is just thinking that, you know, the emotional reality for thousands and thousands of women, is this really a reform? You know, at least if I was having an abortion in an abortion clinic, there were professionals there. There was somebody who would hold my hand. There was somebody who would make me a cup of tea and support me emotionally and be there for me. But if this is happening alone and in my bathroom, some of it feels almost brutal, and, you know, to say that this is an advance in compassionate care, it seems quite hard.
And strikingly, the complete opposite trajectory to the conversation around, you know, miscarriage and the ending of a baby's life from another way. You know, that has all been about, let's bring it into the light, let's talk about this more, let's make sure women don't go through this alone. And here, the trajectory on abortion is the opposite. It's the ultimate privatization of abortion, saying, no, let's push this out of the public sphere into the private sphere, potentially even something that women do completely by themselves, you know, never speaking to another human being except on the phone or on some video consultation at home alone in their bathrooms. Maybe their partners, maybe their other children have no idea what's going on, and saying this is something that women, a road that women must walk or should walk entirely by themselves.
Yes, and, you know, I don't read out these words in any sense to, you know, with any kind of trying to make a point or anything else. But these are the words I found on one of the leading pregnancy abortion providers, where the question was, you know, how should I deal with the pregnancy remains? And what it says on the website is, it says, you will pass the pregnancy at home or another place of your choosing. You can decide how you wish to dispose of the pregnancy remains. They can be flushed down the lavatory, wrapped in tissue, placed in a small plastic bag, and put in the dustbin. And so the contrast between, you know, these are people desperately trying to be compassionate, to be sensitive, to recognize the distress that an abortion must be causing. But the contrast between the narrative that we saw last week, where we were talking about Baby Loss Awareness Week, is very striking.
And I guess the way this connects to our previous conversation about miscarriage is the kind of slightly jarring narratives around the two things. You know, we talked last week about how, thankfully, the language and the culture around miscarriage and baby loss has changed. And now everyone, or increasingly people, would talk about these as babies who were precious, who were human like us, who mattered, and this goes back as young as 2, 3, 4 weeks since conception, that they cannot be replaced, that they count, that they will leave, you know, a lifelong impact on their parents, however short their lives were. And yet at the same time, when it comes to pregnancies which end not in miscarriage but in abortion, we deny almost every element of that. And we talk about, these are not babies, these are fetuses or just pregnancies. They're not human. They're not equivalent to us. the ending of their life won't leave any lasting impact on anyone around them. And it's this, when you hold these two narratives side by side, it's striking.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So I guess the question that then arises for us is, how is it possible that these two different narratives that seem to be almost polar opposites around babies and pregnancies and baby loss, how can they run side by side in a single society? How can a lot of the same individuals believe in both of these stories at the same time?
And my response is that this is fundamentally an unstable situation. This simply cannot persist indefinitely. And I personally think that the baby loss narrative will become more dominant. And that I think that what we need, just as we need to hear the stories, the authentic stories of people of what it felt like to lose a baby, as we already saw on the website and the Baby Loss Awareness Week. So I think we just need to hear the authentic story of what it felt like for women to have an abortion and what their emotions and feelings were. I know from past experience that often when women talk about their own abortions, they often use language about babies. So whereas the professionals are bending over backwards to use extremely sanitized language about pregnancy loss and remains, it seems that often women are more in touch with the reality of what is going on. And therefore, I think that just encouraging people to be honest, not trying to score points. Of course, you know, it is a very polarized situation and everybody's coming from somewhere. And, you know, as a paediatrician and as a Christian, I do strongly believe that every life is precious and every life is unique. And this recognition of the significance of the life of the baby in the womb is something which I think is deeply embedded in our humanity. And it's as though our society is rediscovering this.
Yeah. I mean, the tagline of Baby Loss Awareness Week is breaking the silence around baby loss. And it's hard to disagree with the idea that actually there's another silence, another taboo around abortion, something that, you know, affects a huge number of women, but for whom women often feel unwilling or unable for various reasons to talk about. And it can only be healthy for us as a society to not kind of have this conspiracy of silence and obfuscation, but instead to for people to be honest about how it felt, about who they think was aborted or what was aborted, and to be able to share stories, because, as you say, akin to what was on the Baby Loss website, Awareness Week website. I guess, but another question I would have is, for those who do kind of hold those two things in attention, you know, massive sensitivity around miscarriage and baby loss, and the use of all the language of baby, whilst also a total commitment to a kind of abortion on demand as a fundamental human right for all women, which is probably a large number of people believe those two things side by side, is the way they square that circle all about saying that the status of the child is really dependent on the parent's desire. And so when a child is desired and then they die through miscarriage, that's a tragedy. They are an equal human being to us, and we must, you know, grieve with them as a bereavement. When the child is not desired and they die as a result of an abortion, that is a morally neutral act that wasn't a human being but just a clump of cells. And so, as you say, the kind of morality state, the moral status of the fetus is almost dependent on how their parents think about it.
Yes, I think that many people, including health professionals, really don't want to go there. They don't want to push this to that kind of binary. They would just say, we're being incredibly sensitive. you know, we're taking, this is often called patient-centered care. So I take my cue from the patient. If the patient says, you know, this is a baby, I'm caring for my baby, then yes, we use all the baby language. We're being very patient-sensitive and caring. But if it becomes apparent that the language that is being used, what is being implied, is that this being is not wanted, or that it's a pregnancy or whatever, then we'll be patient-centered. We'll adopt, we'll seamlessly move to this other language. And and many practitioners say, you know, I'm not a philosopher, I'm not a theologian, I'm not going to make any decisions about the moral status of the unborn. I'm simply being sensitive.
And I can see how that is a very helpful way to frame it when you're thinking of yourself as a service provider. These are my clients, even customers, and therefore I need to let them frame what's going on here, and as you say, above all, be sensitive to their language and their terms. But it feels to me fundamentally dissatisfying, because it does seem to say that we don't know or believe or care if that thing, person, whatever you want to think of it, inside the womb is. Like, I mean, in there is an objective reality. There must surely be. Humans cannot be entirely contingent on other human beings. There must be an objective reality. And it feels to me like there's a willful, as you say, refusal to stare that tension in the face and admit to the incoherence, because it's just kind of difficult to acknowledge that we're actually acting in two mutually contradictory ways.
I agree with you. We've been told before in these podcasts we should try and have more disagreement, but I'm sorry, Tim, I'm going to have to agree with you here. I mean, the fascinating thing is that once the baby is born, whether the parents want this baby or don't want this baby makes no difference at all to our commitment to the baby. I mean, now society is saying this baby has a unique value, and the fact that some people want this baby, some people don't want this baby, some people are positive, some people are less positive, you know, some people are wanting giving this baby up for adoption, whatever, doesn't make any difference to the value and the significance of the baby. So there is this extraordinary incoherence. You know, once the baby's born, everybody says it's the unique status of the baby. But it's the unborn, it's the hidden being that we can now have this almost postmodern kind of view. Well, it all depends. It's a language game. And, you know,
the Schrodinger's cat, isn't it? You know, it changes depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, there is something about that. And so that's why I think more discussion about the narratives, more discussion about the reality. And I think this is where the Baby Loss Awareness Week is helpful, because it's just recognizing reality. It's bringing it out of ideology. It's bringing it out of culture wars and pro-life versus pro-choice. And it's just saying, can we please recognize the reality of what's happening here?
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to me that you might actually, you know, have some unexpected allies in this desire to kind of be more honest around abortion from some of the more kind of radical end of the pro-abortion lobby. You know, there's a movement in America I'm aware of called Shout Your Abortion, which is, again, an effort to kind of break the stigma, but it's led entirely by people who believe very passionately in a woman's right to an abortion all the way up to 40 weeks. And they see society's kind of squeamishness to talk about it and to confront what is happening, and insistence that this is a private act that is very sensitive and personal, we don't go there, is kind of a conspiracy of silence that actually hinders their cause of expanding access to abortion. So I think it's fascinating that this idea of telling stories and being more honest about what is going on, you might actually have met at the other end, or come all the way around and met some of people you unlikely allies.
Yes, and there is a kind of theological, spiritual aspect to all this, and that is that, you know, if we ultimately believe that what matters is truth and transparency, and that facing reality, however painful, however difficult it is fundamentally better than cloaking things in silence, using euphemisms, not recognizing the reality of what is taking place in our own homes and our own society. There is a fundamental Christian desire for transparency, honesty, and speaking the truth, but at the same time speaking the truth in love, being sensitive, recognizing this, the deep emotions. And of course, the reality is, you know, for so many women who are choosing to have an abortion, you know, by pills, by post, they're doing it with a desperately heavy heart. They're doing it because they feel there is no alternative, whether it's because they feel with a cost of living crisis, you know, a child at this moment would be just destructive on my future, destructive in my life, destructive in my relationships. But I think the reality when one speaks to women honestly is that so many do feel this deep conflict of what the people who work in crisis pregnancy centres sometimes talk about, the head-heart, the conflict between my head is telling me that this is an entirely rational decision, that now is the wrong time for me to become a mother, and so on, that economically it would be disastrous and it would affect my education and so on. There's all these rational reasons, and yet my heart is telling me something different, that this is my child and that I should care and protect and love my child. And so I think just being honest about the conflict that women find themselves in. And isn't it tragic that it's often because of social pressures or pressures from an unsupportive male partner which is driving women to have abortions, rather than this genuine autonomy? It's my body, it's my choice, I do whatever I like. That, I'm afraid, is by and large a myth.
And there's one very tragic case we didn't mention earlier that kind of elucidates this point you're making, where a woman was convicted of taking pills by post when she was long, long past the legal limit here in the UK. She was between 32 and 34 weeks pregnant, and pills by post are only supposed to be used for pregnancies up to 10 weeks. But she had basically misled when she did her kind of online consultation, was not honest about how far along she was. And she was, you know, ultimately caught and prosecuted and convicted. The child was born not breathing and confirmed dead shortly afterwards. And so she was kind of convicted of inducing an abortion after the legal limit, and initially given a prison sentence of, I believe, two and a half years, which was prompted enormous kind of outrage and outcry here in the UK. But it raises some really difficult questions, particularly as when you find out more about her background, which is that she already had three children. I believe one of them had special needs. She was racked with guilt and suffered depression, and kind of fell pregnant during lockdown when she was quite isolated. And yeah, just a really difficult background. And so you can understand how she got to the place of kind of lying to get access to an abortion. But at the same time, you know, if there is to be a legal limit, then the law has to enforce it, does it not?
Yes. And as you say, there was a great deal of outrage. And there is a movement here in the UK from pro-abortion activists to completely decriminalise abortion, to have it regarded simply as a medical procedure like any other medical procedure, but not to be controlled or governed by specific law. When this case hit the headlines, a number of abortion activists saw this as an opportunity to push their case for decriminalisation. But I think, you know, I have previously argued that the law has a role because it basically reflects what society as a whole believes. And so the question we've got to ask ourselves is, do as a society, do we really believe that the life of a baby who's capable of living and being born alive, that life is to be protected? And basically that's what our law currently says. And the fact that somebody is held to account and found guilty of a law doesn't mean that they are criminalized. It doesn't mean that they have to be treated as a criminal or imprisoned. And so I think actually the subsequent judgment that she was found guilty of procuring abortion illegally, but was not imprisoned and allowed to carry on caring for her existing children, was a just sentence. In other words, there's a distinction between being felt guilty of offending against the law and then deciding what a just sentence should be.
Absolutely. I think, so to end the story, a few months later, the case went to the appeal court, and the appeal court reduced her sentence from 28 months to 14 months and also suspended it, which basically meant that, you know, she wouldn't actually serve 14 months in prison unless she kind of reoffended again in the future, which is obviously highly unlikely. And so she effectively, you know, walked free, but is still a convicted, you know, criminal. And, you know, to use that language, she's broken the law, and she is, released from prison on license, as it were.
There's an analogy here, which I've frequently been involved with discussions about, and that is when a partner, for instance, assists the suicide or of a partner who is begging to be helped to die. For instance, they've got severe terminal illness. Technically, if that partner assists the person in dying out of compassion, they are still guilty of the law of assisted suicide, against the law of prohibiting assisted suicide. But the Crown Prosecution Service in general will say, you know, if it was clear that this was genuinely motivated by compassion, that you didn't get any financial gain of it yourself, and so on and so on, therefore you are not imprisoned. You are you're held guilty of the crime, but you are not treated as worthy of imprisonment. So, and I think that balance between holding the law, but then showing compassion in the way that punishment is enacted, is an important balance.
And there's a reason, isn't there, why in our and in most legal systems there are two separate hearings or two separate legal processes. You have a kind of a fact-finding one where you try and decide, did this person do what they are accused of? And then if they are found guilty, you then have a secondary one, which is, what is the appropriate just punishment for this? And that might be going to prison, but actually in many cases, and not just for these, but lots of other laws, a judge rightly decides, you know, sending this person to prison is actually not going to be in their or in society's wider interest, even though they have broken the law. Let's actually sentence them to a fine, community service, or sometimes just, you know, just it lays on file that, you know, there isn't any actual punishment per se, but except the fact that they have been found guilty in a court of law. And that seems to me important, to keep those two issues separate, whereas I think a lot of the pro-abortion, or at least the pro-decriminalization advocates, use this very difficult case to say the whole law around abortion is clearly unjust, because how can you justify this mother of three going to prison? And therefore, we should sweep away the whole thing, which, as you say, is a slightly deceptive way of saying, actually, I believe that women should be able to end pregnancies at any time of their choosing for any reason, which is a relatively radical position that doesn't have particularly wide support among the British public.
But the other really important thing to say here, and that is that if the previous abortion regulations were being carried out, in other words, if this was not pills by post, what would have happened is that she would have had to have had an ultrasound scan in the abortion clinic. They would have seen immediately that she was much more than 10 weeks. They would have worked out this baby was 30 weeks gestation, and they would have said, absolutely no way, you cannot have an abortion. So it was predicted at the time of pills by post that precisely this thing is going to happen, mothers are going to either deliberately or unintentionally get the gestational age wrong. If you don't do an ultrasound scan, it's bound to happen. And yet those who are promoting it said, no, it's not, nothing to worry about here. You know, we can trust women and so on. So I'm afraid that this kind of incident, where in fact the pregnancy was much more advanced than was anticipated will continue to occur repeatedly. And there are already other cases of it happening. And this is the problem. If you never do an ultrasound scan, if you simply take the mother's word that she's less than 10 weeks.
And what do you think we do about this information? You know, for those of us who, as Christians, would like to see a reduction in the number of abortions that take place, do you think we should kind of leap upon some of these stories or the changes in law around pills by post, and even the growing kind of awareness around miscarriage and baby loss, and kind of hammer that home and use that in our campaigning and say, look, a fetus can't be simultaneously a loved baby or a clump of cells at the same time, and kind of pull people's attention to what we fleshed out with some of the kind of incoherent thinking we have on it? Or is that actually quite exploitative, and is that, you know, instrumentalizing and manipulating around a separate issue, which is, you know, the public policy question of pills by post and question of how do we be more compassionate to those suffering from miscarriage? And it's actually a disservice to people who've experienced baby loss to almost drag them into the bitter, polarized debate around abortion.
Well, I think, you know, you'll put your finger on what is such a dilemma, to know what is a positive, healthy, compassionate response. I think I am convinced that just changing the law is not in itself a solution. You know, the evidence is emerging in the USA that despite the fact that a number of states have made abortion virtually illegal under all circumstances, that the total number of abortions that are taking place across the USA is probably not significantly changed, so that changing the law hasn't led to a very significant reduction in the total number of abortions. It's just meant that a lot of people are passing across state borders or finding other ways of getting access to abortion drugs. So I am a believer in the slogan that says our goal is not to make abortion illegal, it is to make it unthinkable. And so the question is, well, how do we change attitudes? How is it possible for attitudes to change? And I think that's where the baby loss awareness, it is possible that as you help people to tell their stories, as we try to break this silence and then ask the question, you know, is there a better way? Is there a better way of dealing with this problem of unplanned pregnancy? Is there a compassionate and thoughtful way? And the short answer is that I'm sure there is a better way, but we have to bring these issues out into the public. You know, the better way is the way of genuinely providing a positive support for women who are pregnant, helping them to see there is an option. You don't have to have an abortion. Reducing the stigma of being a single parent, providing better welfare and care and compassionate support, reducing the shame, and so on. There are positive ways of responding to an unplanned pregnancy. But first, we have to give people permission, an opportunity to share their stories.
And how would you respond to the accusation that if you start pulling in, you know, language and ideas from Baby Loss Awareness Week to this conversation, you are kind of being as manipulative as some of those pro decriminalization people were when they were jumping on this tragic case of the woman who procured an abortion illegally? You know, a person might say, you know, my miscarriage has nothing to do with your campaign to reduce abortion. Don't drag me into this.
Well, I would say my goal is not to have some massive public campaign talking about don't murder your babies or something like that, because I personally just don't think that helps. There are others who I respect who do believe that using that kind of language and you know, graphically confronting people with images and so on is helpful. I personally think what I would love to feel is to allow the women themselves to tell their stories, because I think that in itself would be very powerful and would cause people to question, you know, what is going on here? Is this a healthy way? Is this a positive social trend? Or is there a better way? That's So I'm not trying to manipulate or coerce or abuse language, but I do would love to see greater honesty and transparency.
And you can see the power of story used very effectively in Baby Loss Awareness Week, you know, which makes a big deal out of sharing the story, some of which we shared earlier on the last week's podcast. And we live in a moment, it feels like to me, a cultural moment in where there is enormous weight placed on the power of story. You know, you see that through like events like Me Too, you know, where people said, actually, hang on, if we just stop and listen to women talking about their experiences of harassment and abuse and assault, that actually, in my view, kind of reshapes society in some significant ways. And so I can certainly see the power of saying, let's encourage and make it possible for women to talk about their abortion stories. And that has a cultural capital right now in Britain, even in secular Britain, that is kind of hard to deny. Right. Well, we've covered a lot of ground there, but I hope it was an interesting conversation to listen into. As I mentioned last week, we don't want to pretend that we have all the answers on this, particularly as two blokes. So please do send us your thoughts, your reflections, your disagreements. We're really interested to hear what you, the listeners, made of this conversation and make of these big kind of cultural shifts that we're seeing around questions of baby loss and pregnancy and abortion. So please do get in touch with us. You can email molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And if you're interested in digging into the question of abortion and Christian ethics a bit more, Dad's got a great section on his website, johnwyatt.com, that kind of takes you through with a kind of primer and then into some kind of gradually unfolding into some more in-depth written pieces and stuff like that. So do take a look at that. That's johnwyatt.com. And otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode of Matters of Life and Ten. We'll be back next week with another episode of Matters of Life and Death. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.